Today I will try to give you some of the history and some of the mechanisms that are underlying the RNAi mechanism. Today it is called as RNAi, but we always call that post-transcriptional gene silencing or co-suppressor, as you will see, or quelling and other names. But after the 1998, the name RNA interference became so popular that everybody knows it as an RNAi. So the story starts with, understand what is going on. Real wants something to me, and I don't understand what they want. Okay, this story starts with this beautiful petunia. There was a company that was trying to overexpress genes that were, you know, coding for enzymes of the flavonoid pathway that gives the color to flowers. And the reason why they were doing that, they wanted just to make flowers looking better and selling it. So they were just trying to introduce extra copies of a given gene, a Chalcone synthase gene, that is one of the intermediate of the production of flavonoids. And they were, this is the endogene, let's say, adding extra copies, not necessarily one copy, but more than one, just trying to see the color would become darker. So Jorgensen was the one publishing the first paper, and the company was the DNA Plant Technology in Oakland, California. Okay, what they learned right away was that instead to get petunias that had a darker color, they got plants showing all varieties of colors, as you see, with a lot of spots, mostly white. 80% of the flowers were instead... Sorry? I haven't seen you... It looks like that it is random. That is the result that they were getting. It is random and depends on the fact that, let's say, the expression of this particular mechanism, let's call it gene silencing, that we don't know nothing about it, right, until that I will try to explain it. It doesn't take place in every cell of the flower, but it takes place in few cells, and this is during development. There are branches, as you see, because here the mechanism is acting, and over here is not. The same is not acting here, acting there. So if you isolate cells from those flowers in the white spot, you will see that the mRNA coding for that particular enzyme is not expressed. If you extract the RNA from sectors where the color is there, you will find the messenger RNA and, of course, the enzyme too. Okay, so it is. It's also the phenomenon is reversible. Somehow you will see that it's reversible, and the reason is that there are mechanisms that where plants and fungi, you will see later, recognize that there are transgene there, and they try to silence those transgene. So when you silence the transgene, you will not get the effect of the presence of the transgene. So it is a very complicated, this is what they were getting, and they were very surprised, of course, and it wasn't easy to explain such a result. Yes, please. Sorry, I couldn't hear. Okay. In you know, that particular gene that it was used contains a promoter, and it's the same, absolutely the same promoter. And it turned out later that when you try to overexpress a transgene, it is normally expressed, it's not overexpressed. If you have many copies, you can have an overexpression, but the result is that if you measure the expression, you find no expression at all. So your surprise is, I tried to overexpress something, instead I don't have any. You are saying that when they were transgenic mouse, they have problems because this is gene silencing that is working there. So let's go, because we will meet the explanations of all your questions now, just looking at those. So they were getting this mostly, as I said, the suppression of the phenotype was so strong that mostly the vast majority of the flowers were white instead. So.
Does it happen in every overexpression
No, it's not always true. It's not always true. You have to have the silencing of the locus, let's say mice. Very often a transgene gets integrated in tandem, and this tandem changes the chromatin status, and that region becomes heterochromatic, or, that is a way to silence it. But we will talk about this the next lecture, you know, when on Thursday we will talk about transcriptional silencing, we will hit this problem. This is post-transcriptional. What we are looking at this today, it is post-transcriptional. Yeah, it doesn't happen all the time. It depends how many integrations you have, if they are close to each other and so on. So what I'm saying here is that very soon they learned that not only the transgene wasn't expressing, but even the endogene was not expressed. That was the real surprise, because if you introduce a transgene, you can always think that for some reason it's not expressed. Because it is broken, because it is integrated in an area where the chromosome is heterochromatic and so is not transcribed. You can have many reasons why a transgene doesn't express, and that is what you are asking. But why the endogene are not expressed? Okay, because this mechanism is not operating there, okay? Okay, in plant, in fungi, and then with the RNAi, you'll see what will happen, but that is... So this phenomenon was called by them a co-suppression, because it's a coordinate suppression of a transgene and the homologous, endogene. Not every endogene, but only the homologous to the transgene that you introduce. So they introduced that specific gene that day, but they could have introduced another one, and the kind of result that they would have seen would have been the corresponding homologous and endogene being silenced also. Okay, at the same time, then we are talking about 1989, 1990, we were working on Neurospora crassa, trying, this is a fungus, you can see the mycelia here growing, the hyphae growing on the media, and Neurospora crassa makes this beautiful orange color due to the fact that accumulate a pigment, and the pigment is beta carotene. And so we wanted to overexpress the pigment, exactly like the people in Petunia, that they wanted to overexpress the pigment. And when we wanted to do this, introducing extra copies of the genes that they were coding for function needed to the biosynthesis of carotenes. And we went up to have a few strains overproducing those, but the vast majority of the strains instead were not producing carotenoids any longer. So this is the wild type one, and those are individuals that have copies of the transgene coding for, in this case, is called albino 1. There are three genes, albino 1, 2, and 3, that codes for three different enzymes needed for the biosynthesis of beta carotene. And using albino 1, but we tested later also albino 2 and albino 3, you can have that 40 to 50% of your transformant, instead to over accumulate the pigment, instead they don't make it any longer. Just a brief story. A year later, or 2 years later, another paper appeared where using a virus in plants to transfect those plants with a virus used as a vector of a gene or a fragment of a gene, they were noticing that not only the plant was responding to something that was called transgene coded by the virus, homologous to something that was endogenous to the plant, but the plant was becoming insensitive to the viral infection, so was becoming resistant to the viral infection. And so this paper really was an important thing, because it was a virus-induced gene silencing, that the plant was becoming somehow resistant to the virus after this infection. And they could see at that time also that because these virus in plants are RNA viruses, that some RNA was involved in this mechanism. Okay, soon, not only in plants or in the Neurospora, a phenomenon was being shown, but a year later, 1994, even in Drosophila, they were doing again the same kind of experiment. They wanted to overexpress the gene that codes for the pigment of the eye pigment, which is called white gene, and of course, overexpressing that particular gene was leading to Drosophilas having the white eyes instead. So again, by serendipity, everybody trying to do an experiment and getting exactly the opposite of what they wanted to do. So this is the story of RNAi. It's just a story of something coming out of the blue. Nobody was expecting to have what we were seeing, but it was just by chance, by serendipity, that something very important came out. Okay, because of we call the phenomenon that we have seen in Neurospora quelling, from the quell, that is, to repress somehow. And we learned that was sequence specific because, you know, you could imagine that you introduce a transgene and something happened to this organism. So it repressed expression of many genes among the one, among them or someone that you have an interest on. And so we showed that instead, let's say, we use the albino one as a transgene, and we measure at the same time the expression not only of the albino one mRNA that should be here, this is in the wild type, but also of the albino 2 and albino 3. Those are two other genes that are also involved in the pigment biosynthesis, but they are happily expressed in strains where the pigment is not made any longer because of the lack of the accumulation of the messenger RNA of the albino 1 gene. The transgene is the albino 1 and the endogene is albino 1, but only the endogene albino 1 is silenced, not albino 1 or 2 or 3. And so this was a way to show that was specific. We tested 7 different genes and we could show that only the gene homologous to the transgene was silenced at the level of not accumulating messenger RNA of the endogene and the transgene. So I will show you in a second that also with the transgene it's the same thing. So we then wanted to know, please. They are genes that are involved in the biosynthesis, but they code for different enzymes, are not paralogs. They are three different, totally different genes. Then we learned that we needed to have what in the transgene we not necessarily needed to use the entire transgene. We could use a portion of it. But which portion? Could be a 5' end, the promoter portion, the 3' end. So here is the result. When we were using the full gene, we were seeing, as I showed you before, that was able to suppress the expression of the endogene. But even using only a fragment of the gene, you see here is only 500 nucleotides of a gene that is 1500. That these 500 nucleotides were sufficient to silence the endogene. If you were using the 500 or 700 nucleotides of the 3' end of the gene, the coding portion, again, the efficiency was very high. And even using only 130 nucleotides of the coding portion of the gene, that is 1500, so it's just 1/10, less than 1/10, is sufficient to induce silencing, not in a 40% of the transformants, only maybe in a smaller portion, 3%, but in those transformants, the silencing was very strong. They were full white, you know, they were not accumulating carotenoids at all. Instead, using promoter regions, you know, regions that are upstream of the gene, but they are important for the expression of any gene, instead the promoter region didn't work at all. So every time using promoter region won't work for getting silencing. This is 100 and, yeah? No, they come from the coding portion. Okay, I show you again. This is the coding portion, starts from here to here, and this one is? Okay, now I understood. No, actually, what I'm showing here, that this piece of DNA correspond to the gene, but is not a gene in terms of having a promoter, a coding portion, and some regulatory regions. Those are purely 500, 700 nucleotides. These 130 nucleotides are cloned into a vector without any promoter, okay? So those are without any promoter, bacterial promoter, eukaryotic promoter, any promoter is present, okay? No promoter is present. This promoter instead is the endogenous promoter of albino 1 that could eventually have an effect on silencing the albino endogenous sequences, okay? So there is no promoter. So then we learned that both endogenous genes and transgenes were silenced, so we had the case of co-suppression too, and the experiment was done this way. This is the endogene, so this is the chromosome, let's say, and we were using either a gene perfectly able to express itself, in a sense that using the same construct into an albino 1 mutant, so unable to synthesize carotenes, and you could complement that mutation by adding this vector containing this sequence, and the sequence express itself and, you know, produce the pigment. So the endogene is identical to the transgene, and the transgene, when it's used with the promoter, is able to express, but anyhow, you see that 40% of the transformers are silenced anyhow. And the same result that we are getting with the fraction of DNA or the entire coding portion without the promoter. So you see that even the transgene that could be expressed, it is silenced. That's why we call that co-suppression, because both endogene and transgene would be silenced. Okay, we learned that this phenomenon was acting at a post-transcriptional level. In a sense that the first question was, what happened? We are measuring an mRNA and we don't find it. So, means that it's being degraded, but maybe it may mean that it's not transcribed at all. And so will be some kind of inhibition of the transcription. And then we measure the rate of transcription of the albino 1 gene, and we found that the gene is normally expressed in the quell strains, where you have no pigment accumulating, where you have no messenger accumulating, but the precursor RNA, the one that is made into the nucleus and then processed to remove, let's say, introns, it is there. And is there at the same level in a wild-type strain, in the non-silent strain, but transformed with, and in a silent strain. So that tells you that the transcription goes perfectly normal, but is the accumulation of the mature mRNA that doesn't take place. You know? Please.
When you tested the sequence specificity, did you also try purely intronic sequence?
Yes, we did, using, even though in Neurospora it's difficult because introns in Neurospora are 70 to 80 nucleotides long, but there is one that is 500, but is an exception there. But we use it also in tronic sequences, and we made it a ton of repeats to have a sequence long enough, and doesn't work. So introns are totally ineffective in Neurospora. We noticed it, something that you will be now surprised about it, that the gene silencing was correlating with the presence of transgenic tandem repeats. You see the result here. You had to have tandem repeats. So, saying you transform Neurospora, you take a bunch of transformers that are orange and a bunch of transformers that instead are white. And you ask, did I introduce any DNA in those that are white or orange? So we had markers, so we knew that DNA was in there because they were able to expressing another gene, use it as a marker. But then we did the southern blot, so we digested DNA with restriction enzymes, and with a probe that was radioactive, we were able immediately to see that in the silent strain you have a large amount of DNA that is introduced. Instead, in the strains that are not silenced, that 60% that doesn't show silencing, you have much less DNA from the transgene. But also, what you could note here is that there is a tandem repeat, head-to-tail tandem, and the reason why we can say that is because we use a restriction enzyme that cuts once in the entire element that we introduce it, and so will be, if you have a tandem, you will make slices of this only of the same length, each one, and so you can measure how many of those repeats are present in this in tandem. And here you can see there are 20 to 30, sometimes to 40 repeats present. So there is a correlation with tandem repeats and the silencing phenomena. Then we found one more thing, that is that there is an accumulation of unexpected, and this is to explain that there is unexpected because there is no promoter. So you would not expect to have any RNA made on the transgene because you don't have promoters there. And this particular RNA was derived from the transgene, and we could recognize that. It was chimeric because the vector sequences were present in the transcript. So we were able to measure that the vector was transcribed to not only the neurospora portions introduced via vector into neurospora. So it was transcription, general transcription of all this area, and that particular transcript was accumulating only in strains that were silent. So you see here is an RNA that is accumulating only here and not there. And this particular RNA, I should explain how we measure that. We measure it via a mechanism that is called RNase protection. So we were, I put just a note here, sorry, it would be a very brief way to do that. So you have, let's say you have an RNA, you can make an antisense RNA by cloning and in vitro transcription, and this antisense RNA would be complementary to a portion of what you want to study. Suppose that will be complementary to this region, okay? So you can add to your RNA that is synthesized in vitro also a sequence that is not complementary to the target sequence. And so you will be able to say, my probe is 150 nucleotides long, of which 100 are complementary to a given target, okay? So what you do now, you transcribe this and you make it this radioactive. So this will be radioactive. Then you extract RNA from the cell. You try to make an hybrid, and they will hybridize. And now you can treat this product with an RNase. And those RNases are able only to degrade single-stranded RNA, not double-stranded. And so those regions will be degraded, and you will be left with the portion that is perfectly complementary. And that depends how big you want to have it. I decided 100, but could have been 70 or 300 or whatever. And then the band that you see here are exactly these 100 or 70 or 300 that I decided to test against the endogenous one. So as you see, making a probe like this, we were able to show that these were the product of the digestion, because this tail that we put in there has been removed. So it's the product of the digestion. And then the leftover was exactly the length that you were expecting. And so that was telling you that there was an RNA present into the cell that was corresponding exactly to this. So we tested regions that were complementary to the neurospora clone portions, or to the vector one, or something that was bridging it. So you had the vector sequences, neurospora sequences, and we bridged them, and we discovered that this RNA was containing the entire clones. Okay, so means that it was a transcript. Yeah, you can turn it off because I finished the explanation. So that was a way to show that only in silent strains there was an RNA that was made without a promoter on the transgene, and that this RNA was also chimeric, you know, made with different... Thank you. Okay, so the next thing that we published, these things in... So in 1996 was already known that there was an RNA that was important. But in this paper, the most important part was not only having discovered the correlation with an RNA made from the transgene that was correlating with silencing, but the most important part is that there were two other phenomena. One, that there was a reversion via excision of transgenic copies, and so the silencing was unstable. After many generations, the phenotype that was white was reappearing being orange, because extra copies that we introduced were removed. I show you, in a wild type you have an endogene that is the albino 1 endogene, and then the white transformat are the ones where silencing is taking place, okay? And here you can see that you have many copies of the transgene. I had to say that these portions in this southern is because that DNA, it's also methylated, so it is modified chemically, the C's are methylated, and then restriction enzymes have difficulties on cutting on some sequences, and that's why you have a very high molecular weight bands. But that tells you that you have many transgenic sequences. Please, yes. We used the 3' UTR sequence, they didn't work. Okay? Only the coding portion seemed to work. So now you see two white strains, and both of them have a large number of transgenes there. You have an intermediate one that is now yellow color, and you have much less transgenic sequences. And now you have an orange transformant that they have lost, the white phenotype. And you see that the copy number of the transgene went down to 1, let's say. So these are a ratio 1-to-1 with the endogene. So that tells you that you start from a strain that has 40 copies, and you end up, after reversion of the phenotype, down to almost only 1 copy. So there is an active mechanism of excisions of transgenic copies that make the mechanism being reversible. Okay. Then the last, but the most important part, is that we discover that we could do an experiment and show that this RNA was acting in trance. And so the reason why we are saying so is, if you know that Neurospora crassa as an organism is a syncytium, okay? It's a long tubing full of nuclei in a common cytoplasm, okay? So you could think that this organism has different nuclei, they could be different depending on what you have done it with, in a common cytoplasm. So the surprise, when you transform an organism like that, a few nuclei are transformed, but the vast majority of them are not transformed. So the idea was, why we see a silencing of the expression of those genes when only a few nuclei are transformed and all the others are not? So we made the experiment this way. This is a schematic cartoon to explain to you. So the experiment is the following. Now you take two strains, one that is a wild-type strain, and the other one that is an albino 1 mutant. This albino 1 mutant cannot express that gene because it has a mutation in it, and so it is white. So if now trying to put the two groups together, they will fuse, okay? They will mix their cytoplasm, and they will have a common cytoplasm at different nuclei. Nuclei that come from the wild type one, and nuclei that come from the albino one. And then you ask the question, which is the color of the strain? The strain will be orange because the albino's genes produce a pigment, and the pigment, of course, is dominant. It will make colorful of all the heterokaryon. Now you can do another experiment. It's the following. Now I'm going to use a wild-type strain, and I will fuse it with an albino sequence, but this time it is a suppressed one. It's a quell strain. It's not a truly albino mutant. It's just a silenced one. And ask, what happens if now I fuse this mycelia and get an heterokaryon where I will have a quell strain, a silenced one, a quell nucleus, and we went up to 10 wild-type nuclei as a ratio. And the result was that the heterokaryon was white, demonstrating that here there is something that is produced that acts in trance and will silence, everything into the heterokaryon. So this was the beautiful, I have to say, because we have done it with our hands and was really impressive to see it, idea that was something produced that was acting in trance and was dominant. And in the same paper, we showed that that was an RNA. So we knew that was an RNA working in trance, having the ability to be dominant, so being very strong, and to silence, all the other nuclei. Please.
In plants, were they also able to graft plants?
They had done this experiment after us, a couple of years later, and learning it from us.
It
does work beautifully in the same way. So if you graft a silenced plant on a plant that is not silenced, you can graft a silenced one, And then this silence will spread on a portion of the plant that is, so it is systemic. So we could not call this systemic because it is syncytium in our case. So what won't go from one cell to another is a kind of a single cell. But that was the indication that suggested the plant people to do the same experiment, because we published this and they knew our experiment. We were within the same AU group. Okay, so at this point we had in our hands an important mechanism. There was a gene silencing operated by a transgene via an RNA that was having a dominant action. So we decided, and we are talking about 1996, before that the results of RNAi came out, we decided to go after genes that maybe were involved in such a mechanism. So we decided to isolate mutant in this mechanism. And our mutants have been the first mutants in every organism showing impairment in the mechanism. And so those mutants, we decided to use the genetics, of course, that in Neurospora it's kind of easy, and to isolate those mutants in the mechanism. So what we did, we took a stable silent strain. Remember that I told you that they have the ability to revert. So if the reversion rate is 1 out of 1,000, you are in trouble. You have to have a reversion rate of this that is 1 out of 10,000. So then you will have a strain that is stable enough to work. So among many, we isolated one strain having 40 copies of the transgene in tandem, but being stable. And so we are able to grow it without seeing reversion. So then what we did, either mutagenized by UV light and later by insertion of mutagenesis. And so the phenotype that we were expecting was the following. You have a gene silencing mechanism operating there. The albinos are genes that could be expressed. They are not expressed because the silencing is working. So now if you introduce a mutation in a gene that is essential for silencing, this phenotype may revert. And so you will have the color coming out. And so we were able to show on our plates that a few hundreds of colonies out of almost 100,000 show up an orange phenotype. So we picked those revertants, okay, and we decided to look at if they were mutated in what kind of genes eventually. So what we did was screening for orange revertants, and then we did a complementation test. So, as I told you, Neurospora is able to make heterokaryons, okay? So if I have a mutant and a second one, and I put them together, they will fuse. If they are mutated in the same gene, you will not see any changes. But if they are mutated in two different genes, one will complement the other mutation, and so the corresponding heterokaryon will be able to express the phenotype, a different phenotype. And so by this test, we were taking 50 mutants, 50 revertants, and we just fuse each one against all the other, and we noticed that each one was able to recover the color, showing that they were different genes, or not recovering the color as an indication of the same gene mutated. And so because of this work that was done, we came out with three different complementation groups in which revertant such and such was containing the quellin deficient one group, and so that probably it was a gene. And so all these were unable to complement each other because they had the mutation in the same gene. These two were unable to complement each other because of the same reason in another gene, but this one was able, when fused in an heterokaryon with M2 and M10, they were recovering the orange color because one was mutated in one gene, one was mutated in the other one, so that would allow them to complement and to give rise to the original color. So we came out with three different complementation groups corresponding to this. Then this was tested with UV, and then we said, okay, now we need to find what kind of genes are those. So we repeated this experiment using insertional mutagenesis. So we transformed Neurospora with a plasmid, with any kind of plasmid, and this plasmid was inserted in everywhere in genomes, and at one point where transformant with orange phenotypes were appearing, and so we isolated those, And we tested them again with the same method, and we found again that there were three different complementation groups. But now the mutagenesis operated through the insertion of mutagenesis, so it was something getting into a gene. So just exploiting the fact that a sequence, a known sequence, went into a gene and was destroying it, we were able to, by PCR, to isolate flanking regions, probably containing the broken gene, and then use those as probes to go to libraries, and then isolate an intact gene and test if that particular intact piece of DNA was able to complement the mutation that we were isolating in those reverts. And that was the kind of work that we did. It wasn't easy, but at the end it came out that we were very successful because we were able to find genes that now you look at is, I know them, because you know them because in 1999 we published this paper on Nature, and this one on Science, this one on Nature, where we were able to isolate those three functions involved in gene silencing. So the first one is, as you can read, an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, okay? So we knew that because it was homologous to other genes known to have such a characteristics. And so that we were able to show that was having an hypothetical function like that. Later on, a couple of years later, a Finnish group isolated this protein from Neurospora, and they were able to show that in vitro that protein was really able to make a single RNA, single-strand RNA, double-stranded. So the real function, enzymatic function of QD1, it is an RNA-dependent, RNA polymerase. Then the second one that we isolated was a DNA helicase, you know, of the RAQ family. I will say a few words about it because it can be very interesting. We have a paper coming out soon that we say more about it. And then the third gene that we isolated immediately after that was what is known now argonaut. Argonaut come from plants, and those proteins are from the past PV family, and we called that at that time QD2. We could not isolate at the same time mutants in dicers, and I'll tell you in a minute what dicer is. You may already know, but I will replay that, because we had two dicer genes, and they overlap as a function. So if you have a mutation in one, there is the other one still working. So to show that we had the functional dicers in Neurospora, we had to tear it down both. We had to mutate it both. And then we had the phenotype, a silencing phenotype, because of this characteristic. So, and very recently, a week ago, has been published another gene called Q1P. That's very interesting, and I will tell you later on something. Just came out, this paper. Okay, so the QD3 gene that is a RAQ helicase, as you see, this particular family of DNA helicases are present from E. coli to human. And in human, there are five different paralogs. And the incredible thing is that most of them are involved in human disease. So if you have this particular RAQ, when it's mutated, it develops a Werner syndrome, which is a very terrible syndrome when the person having a point mutation in this particular gene, they age so fast that at the age of 14, they look like 70. And they, all of them develop very bad cancer rate, and so they die very, very soon. And then there's a Bloom syndrome, where again, it's a terrible syndrome where the recombination in the chromosomes is very high, and that leads to cancer. And so those people also develop such a high rate of cancer that die quite young. And then there are two more involved in other terrible diseases. But recently, one called RAQ1, which is the most similar to the Neurospora classic QD3, has been discovered recently in humans involved in some kind of gene silence. I'll tell you a few words later on. And so, which are the function of RAQ? Well, it is known that they're involved in DNA recombination, in DNA repair, and so in genome stability, and in aging. The Werner syndrome, it's clear example, but in Saccharomyces cerevisiae, this particular gene, which is present only in one single copy, when it's mutated, The yeast age much, much faster. So it is a function linked to aging in Saccharomyces cerevisiae and in humans. So it's the same protein that somehow control aging in both organisms. So this is a general scheme. You see in E. coli, human, and yeast, they all hyper-recombine. So they have a high rate of recombination there. They usually recognize forks, holiday junctions, or very strange helices in very G-rich sequences. DNA can have strange structures having a tetra helix, you know, an helix made with four different helix for in that particular region. And these proteins usually interact with top isomerase or with protein involved in DNA synthesis. So as you see, from E. coli to man, going through yeast and Neurospora, they roughly do the same thing. And so the model that we had in mind at that time was we had an inverter repeat. Remember, tandem repeat that I discovered to you. So we could have a perfect tandem repeat, so as long as 20, 40 repeats, or eventually in one of the repeats they could have a tail-to-tail or head-to-head repeats, instead to be head-to-tail and so having the same orientation. They could have a kind of producing eventually by transcription a double-stranded RNA, just because the sequences were kind of palindromic sequences, and being able to pair and produce a double-stranded RNA. So this was one model that we had in mind, but we could demonstrate that it wasn't the good model, because if a double-stranded RNA would be made directly by the tandem repeat, you wouldn't need an RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And so we showed that instead, in these particular strains, you always needed to the RNA-dependent RNA polymerases making the double-stranded. So wasn't able to do it by itself. And then we showed that QD3 was interacting with the top isomerase 1, because when using drug against it, we were seeing a differential silencing, and it was already known in other organisms being able to pair with or to link to. So the idea is that you have a transgenic tandem repeat, and usually when the DNA open up, those sequences that are identical, they can match and produce complicated structures that need an RQ helicase to be resolved. That's why you need the helicase that will unwind the DNA we stretch out. And that could lead to an altered chromatin status, and then eventually on the particular locus, an aberrant RNA would be made. I'll go back on this concept of aberrant RNA soon, via an aberrant transcription, and this could be the trigger of gene silencing, okay? Then this RNA would be made double-stranded eventually by the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. Okay, so just a paper just submitted from Carlo Cogoni, which was a former postdoc in my lab that has done most of the work that I presented to you. Now he's a professor. He works next door on my lab, and now he's still working on Neurospora. And he showed that there is a physical association with the protein that is needed for DNA replication. RPA is a protein that binds single-stranded DNA and is important for DNA replication. Without RPA, that is lethal. There is no DNA replication any longer. So he was able to show that these two proteins, the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase and RPA, are linked together because they co-immunoprecipitated. So they used antibodies against the RDP, and they were able to find RPE by mass spectrometry, and they used antibodies against RPE, and they were able to find RDP, showing that they are effectively bound to each other. And RPA is known to be nuclear, and QD1 also has been found to be localized into the nucleus. So, but what's more important here is that RQ DNA helicases, of the kind that I showed you, it's also known to be bound to RPE in humans and in yeast. He wasn't able to show that they too are bound together in Neurospora because the immunoprecipitation didn't work correctly. But because of this, you could assume the RecQ and DRP are somehow together via the RPE. Okay? And so The important thing that this model predicts that during DNA synthesis, you may have, during the replication, you can have some kind of slippage because you have a long single stranded that are homologous to each other or identical to each other, and they can produce a complex structure. And then you have the synthesis of an aberrant RNA, and the RNA polymerase, which is present there, RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, can make a double-stranded RNA. So now you think the double-stranded RNA sits on the DNA, but only in regions where the RecQ helicase is needed to resolve structures. So as soon as you have repeated sequences that may assume strange configuration of the DNA, the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase will be there, carried by the RecQ helicase. And then transcription takes place, and this enzyme makes directly the double-stranded RNA, directly on the locus, that is the transgenic locus, organized in tandem, that is the trigger for gene silencing. So you see the mechanism, how does it work, through this new information you can see. But the beauty of this is that if you now block the DNA synthesis, okay, you may ask yourself, silencing will take place or not? And you discover that silencing is not taking place any longer. So if you block DNA synthesis, the silencing is not, and we measure silencing via the small 21 or 25 nucleotides long RNA that I will tell you in a minute. You can block it.
There is no replication.
It's not replication, and then you can measure that the. Well, you have a strain that is growing. So when we do this experiment, they are always growing. And so every 2 hours they have to have a run or replication, because this is a fungus that takes only 2 hours to replicate, to duplicate the mass and so on. So you, when in all our experiments, those are alive strains that grow. Okay. And yeah. And so the sign of silencing taking place is the production of this tiny RNA called small interfering RNA. And so you find that small interfering RNA are not made if you block the DNA synthesis. But if you release the block, after 4 hours they appear again. Okay, so that is real, a strong indication that DNA synthesis is necessary to make the RNA that will be double-stranded and later with Dicer will be cut in fragments. And the last thing is that instead, if you use a palindromic DNA, your transgene contains a palindromic sequences, then you don't need any longer to have tandem repeats, and you don't need DNA synthesis any longer to have the production of the tiny RNA, because the palindrome, it is transcribed, it will make a double-stranded RNA, and the double-stranded RNA will be degraded by the Dicer enzyme, and so the siRNA will accumulate anyhow. So this is, really tells you that the silencing via a palindromic DNA, double-stranded RNA, is a little bit different from what happened with the transgene, because a transgene has to be transformed in double-stranded RNA. A palindromic RNA doesn't have to be transformed in double-stranded, because we'll make by itself a double-stranded RNA. And so that is what Fire and Mello have discovered, that adding directly double-stranded RNA, you can skip all these other parts. You don't need to add the transcription of the transgene and the necessity to make it double-stranded. Yes, please. Yes, in general.
But then you can have maybe some rare cases where there are
Actually, we tested for that. We couldn't find any. So, like, the mechanism is able to do it. Actually, we made it, sometimes we use it, we wanted to increase the number of tandems, so we decided to clone 3, 4, 5 fragments at once in tandem and introducing it into Neurospora. And there is a very strong rearrangement of all these, but they always stay in tandem, okay? Direct tandem, never inverted. So you have to make an E. coli inverted sequences, and then you can use that. In Neurospora, doesn't do that. Must lack some enzyme to do. Yes.
Did you try to find aberrant transcripts on a genome-wide scale and just to detect them?
You see, on a genome-wide scale, looking if you have siRNA that are produced from elsewhere.
Yes.
I'll tell you next time. Next lecture, I'll tell you that it is. But that is the mechanism is operating naturally in Neurospora. Today, I'm showing our action on Neurospora, introducing a transgene, and Neurospora respond this way, you know, to silence homologous genes. But what does it do, Neurospora, normally when scientists are not around, you know, to give problems to it? So, which is the natural function of gene silencing? But this is the second lecture that I will give you at the end of the week. Yeah, wait a few more minutes and then I will tell you something. So I wanted just to make you noticing that when we isolated the RecQ helicase for many years, we are talking about 1990 up to now, so 6 years, of this particular protein, nobody spoke about it. So it was something of Neurospora crassa. It wasn't important in elegans, it wasn't important in any other organism. So it was something strange, fungi are strange. Then recently, they have isolated in mouse testes or in humans also, they found that there are small RNA called PI RNA, and they are 29 to 30 nucleotides long, so a little longer than the usual 21, 22, 23, that in Neurospora it's 25. And these RNA are not made through dizer, though they are made by a different mechanism that is not known yet. And they found that these little RNA are associated with argonaut, with this, which is the usual protein that binds them. I will talk about that in a minute. And to this complex, there is the RecQ, the human RecQ helicase that is associated to the complex. Only in testes, so where, over there, for some reason, to silence those portions of the genome that need to be silenced in sperms, you need to have a RecQ helicase there, okay? So the function of this is not known, but yes, please.
How is RecQ1 expressed in humans? In what kind of...
It is normally expressed, you see, so it was known to be expressed, but in testes they found the protein associated with argonaut and associated with those particular PI RNA. So there seems to serve a specific function. But what is it doing there? Nobody knows. The only thing that is known is that in Neurospora it is involved in gene silencing, and they say, okay, so it may have some function in gene silencing too in testes. But nothing else has been done. But I want just to tell you that even, you see, Neurospora and mammalian still share the same functions after many hundreds of millions of evolution. Okay, so now the next piece of evidence is the fact that small RNA accumulate in silenced organisms. The first paper came out from Hamilton and Balcom in 1999, where they showed that sense and antisense 25 nucleotides long RNA molecules accumulate only in plants that are suppressed, okay, or silenced. That was the first evidence that the RNA was... both sense and antisense, but that was very tiny. We showed before that was kind of long without being able to show that was very small. At the same time, a few months later, it came out a paper from Zamor et al. That showing that doing a Drosophila cell sap, they were just making a juice of Drosophila, nothing more than juice, they were able to add double-stranded RNA to it, and to show that these double-stranded RNA were chopped in 21, 22 nucleotides long fragments. So instead to be degraded or unprocessed, it was just chopped in with regular fragments. So this was the first paper showing that there was an enzymatic activity able to recognize double-stranded and to cut it in small fragments. So they found the small fragments, and immediately after they found it in another organism like Drosophila that the enzyme able to produce those tiny RNA was dizer. Okay. And this is, you can see them in Neurospora. So you have the sense and anti-sense markers. In the wild type, you don't have it. In the quelled strain, in the silent strains, you have both the sense and anti-sense 25 nucleotide long RNA that accumulates, corresponding in this case to the albino one. So this is the transgenic construct, and we made sense probes from the portions that is identical between the endogene and the transgene, and with these kind of probes we were able to show that in the quelled strains they were in Neurospora too, not only in plants and in Drosophila, these 25 nucleotides accumulating. But what we had in our hands that they didn't have in their organisms was we had the mutants. And so we could ask, well, these RNA are made, but how do they fit in the mechanism? Are they upstream or downstream of those functions? So we had the quelling deficient mutant, and so we could ask, are those genes, those proteins necessary to produce the small RNA, or they are not necessary? And so we discovered that in the QD1, RNA-dependent RNA polymerase, when you introduce the transgene, the siRNA, the small intervening RNA, do not accumulate. The same thing is the QD3, which is the reticulicase. They do not accumulate, indicating that they are working upstream of the production of the tiny RNA. Okay? And so they are needed for the production. And instead, in the mutant, the QD2 mutant, there is an accumulation there, indicating that the function of the argonaut proteins, it is downstream of the tiny RNA. At that time, when we did this experiment, it was not known at all. That was the first indication that argonaut was, you know, somehow, in this paper, interacting with the tiny RNA. We were able to immunoprecipitate argonaut and to find in the complex the small RNA. That was the first indication of that. And the only thing that we didn't discover, and I'll tell you soon, that these QD2 accumulating siRNA, they are not single-stranded, as in here, but they are double-stranded. We didn't know because we didn't run a gel that wasn't a denaturing one. This is a denaturing one, and so they run the same way. If we would have run a gel in non-denaturing condition, we would have learned that they would migrate in a different way. And now, just a paper that just came out explains what happened there, and I am going to tell you in a minute. So, here you have a portion of the mechanism, that is, you have a long double-stranded RNA, long or not too long, that is called siRNA precursor. Then the Dicer enzyme is able to bind to it, and will cut 21 to 25 nucleotide long double-stranded RNA, leaving at the 3' end of both strands two nucleotides over stacking. And then this particular product now will has to give this product, double-stranded RNA, made 21 nucleotide long, to the argonaut protein. So the mechanism that is in every paper predicted... So Dicer, I'm going to show you Dicer for the first time. Dicer has the ability to cut a double-stranded RNA because it has four different locations in the protein, active sites, let's call it, that are able to introduce nicks. And the nicks are introduced at two nucleotides of differences. So we introduce two nicks here and two nicks there, and that will leave the 21 nucleotides free from a double-stranded RNA. So the enzyme that has been crystallized shows four positions where it can make nicks in a double-stranded RNA. Sorry, I have problems on hearing, and so that's why I come to you.
Why Dicer is cutting one time 21, 23, 24, and not all the same?
You know what? It's a question that everybody of us has in mind, but I believe that the Neurospora one always makes 25 nucleotides long, the plant one makes 25, but a different Dicer makes 29, and in Drosophila is roughly 23. And in humans is 21, something like that. You know, so it must be the protein that has the sites a different distance, and so cleaves.
So in one organism, it's always the same then.
Even though sometimes you find a mixture of it, right? And so nobody was able to explain why there is a mixture of. Essentially, they are 21, let's say, in elegance, in humans, and so on. But you find also 22, 23.
Play a role. That means a lot of diseases, a lot of pattern, it's shorter, or then you have at the same distance more nucleotides, that is why it's a little bit longer and shorter.
I am afraid that we have to do lots of biochemistry before that we understand what's going on there. The only picture that we have, the cloning those things and measuring the length of it, we found that there is a kind of, not they are not all identical. Sometimes even the one that have the same sequence, in the case of microRNA, they don't have the same length. You can clone the same microRNA of a different length or with one or two nucleotide differences. Yes,
and
please.
Typically the fuzziness in the length in the case of microRNAs is actually happening at the three-prime end of the mature microRNA.
So
it's
not understood, yeah.
So you get to the same microRNA, you get a range of 18 to 24.
You see, and so it could be a post-transcriptional process there that will mature that, or the dicer can associate with other proteins and being able to introduce those cuts at different length. It's something that we just don't know, I believe.
Actually, I was curious about this point from the gel that you were showing before.
Yeah.
When you look at the antisense, it looked like you had a second little band, or one big band.
You are saying the difference is between these two?
No.
This one?
Yeah, you have a little.
This is present in all, even in a wild type. So
it's a background.
It's just background, yes. Okay. So then, in this particular cartoon, is it written that dicer will produce a double-stranded, then there is an unwinding of it, and then the unwinded one will be bound by argonaut, and that will be used to cleave a target RNA. But that's what I wanted to tell you, that the paper that just came out from you in Neurospora shows a beautiful story. He isolated a protein, which is QD2, associated protein, converts duplex siRNA into single-stranded. So you have here double-stranded RNA. The paper, it's on Genes and Development, February 27, is online, so it's not been printed yet, but it just came out a week or 2 weeks ago. And so you have double-stranded RNA, then you have dicer that is able to bind to it. Dicer will produce by cut these 25 hybrid, and then you have a way to pass this to the complex called QD2, which is the argonaut protein, and then QD2, as almost every argonaut, has an endonucleolytic activity that will cut one of the two strands exactly in the middle, so 10 nucleotides from one side will be cut. At that point, you will have the situation where the QD2 made a cut on one of the two strands, and now this protein, which is an exonuclease, will degrade this from the nick, this portion, and so will be released. And so now QD2 will be loaded only with a single strand. And this takes place in both sense. So the double-stranded RNA can get in one direction or in the other direction, and at the end you find that roughly the number of sense and antisense sequences that are present on QD2 are equal. So there is no a way to direct which one gets in, right? In microRNA is different because the direction, first of all, in microRNA, in general, you find only one of the two strands that are accumulating. The other one disappeared. Not for every microRNA, but for the vast majority, that is what happened. And so the question was, how come that only one strand is protected and the other one is not? And it seems that in one side of the double-stranded there are lesser hydrogen bond, and so there is a kind of test. If I can open it easier from this side, I do it in this side, and I don't do it in the other one. So it's a way to test it and opening it from the side where there is lesser hydrogen bond. So that The selection comes from testing it, which one of the two ends would be open. And eventually, if you open from one end, you save one strand. If you open the other end, you save the other strand. But maybe it's not that the explanation. Now that we know that there is some specific function that could do this job, eventually, even with the microRNA processing, it could work eventually. So we don't know yet. So this is a nice story to tell you that, again, this is the way Neurospora has a single strand. And they discover it because they run the gel in a QD2 mutant in a native form, and so they discovered the two bands were migrating in a different way, and they started to do the work by that thing. This protein, it's necessary for silencing. Actually, if they knock out this protein, the silencing doesn't take place any longer, so it is really essential. Okay, so this is the argonaut protein, where you have the 21-25 nucleotide that sits in there, and now, you know, you have this kind of a canyon there where the target RNA could sit in there, and argonaut has an endonucleolytic activity that will cut this messenger RNA exactly 10 nucleotides from one end of the siRNA, and as soon as this RNA is cleaved in two, exonucleases will degrade it. And so the model that comes out that was a model that I will modify now.
It also could be asked for that the location of the nucleotide where the cutting occurs is measured from the bifram end?
No, nobody has done that study. So I'm assuming, because the argonaut proteins are doing that in Neurospora is happening the same thing, but nobody has measured that. Essentially, we have been the only group working on Neurospora since Liu, that now is starting to. He's a very good biochemist, and he now will do the work, because we cannot keep working on Neurospora in Italy. They decided that fungi will not be funded, so no money since several years. So we have to stop to work. So all of us are working on humans now, doing something else, because they decided that no money for fungi. So I'm glad to know that here in the States now, Liu, which is a good biochemist, will work on Neurospora gene silencing. But we will not produce more results in the future. But anyhow, so this is the general model, okay? The model here, you have the genome, endogenes, every endogene there. And depending on which transgene you introduce in there, you can have the action of the polymerase there, the RecQ helicases, so somehow will produce a signal leading to an aberrant RNA, single-strand RNA production, and then the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase will make it double-stranded, and then the ISER will cut it in small fragments. This will be loaded on the QD2, and QEP will help to degrade complementary sequences. And a complementary sequence could be either the aberrant RNA or the mRNA. But since Carlo Cogoni had these new results, he had to change this idea and change the nucleus, let's say. Now, that was I was indicating the nuclear portion by this cage, and now I'm changing the cage on this, saying, okay, now this is the nuclear portion. You have still the endogenes into the nucleus, you have the transgene to the nucleus, but all this, it may happen into the nucleus, because QD1 via RPE is linked to QD3, and so the aberrant RNA is made there, and double-stranded RNA are also made inside the nucleus. Then how it gets out, because Dizer seems to be cytoplasmic, we don't know, but I would say that now the more closer to reality model that we can produce in Neurospora is that all these functions are nuclear. Okay, so then we
Maybe you're going to get that and you could tell me that maybe you'll tell us, but you said the new QPI is also essential for...
Yeah, it is essential, yeah.
And I was curious if you could comment on the saturation of the genetic screen, because this suggests that...
That was a surprise for us, because we did we thought that we saturated the genetic screen, and we were very surprised to find a new gene that we couldn't find. We isolated roughly 100 mutants, and all those fell into the same three complementation groups. Dicer did not, because they were overlapping functions, so it was easy to explain why. This 2AP came out as a surprise, because, you know, actually they didn't get it as a mutant. They mutated later after having discovered that. Yes? You want to know what aberrant means, right? I know somebody that is very important in the field, that when in 1995 I get these lectures and I spoke about the aberrant RNA, said, I don't even know how to spell it. And now it's one of the leading scientists in the world in this field, okay? But he said, I don't even know how to spell it, because he never heard the word aberrant. And aberrant means some. No, sorry. No, I'm not. I'm not spell. No, sorry. I'm not trying to offend you. I'm trying to explain why I use the word. This word. No, I'm not trying to offend you. Sorry. What I'm saying is, we could show that DRNA produced by the transgene was having some peculiar characteristics that wasn't the same of the messenger RNA, and this peculiar one was making it different, aberrant. But what kind of aberrance he has there is there, we still don't know. But now, since what I've told you that has been submitted, not even published, you know what aberrant means. It's an RNA that is made in this complex, and the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase is able to recognize in this complex any RNA that is made. Okay? That will be the complex between the RQ helicases, RPE and other proteins, plus the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So there is a transcription there in a locus that is strange. And so the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase recognizes only the RNA, not a messenger RNA in the cytoplasm, because they will not meet, but exactly in the locus where the transgene is present. So aberrant now means that it's localized into that particular region of the DNA. Doesn't have a poly A tail, doesn't have a cap probably, but not necessarily those are the aberrant characteristics. Maybe that is made in one specific locus that where the transgene and is recognized because it's made there, and so will be transformed into double-stranded.
Do you have translational silencing in the diaspora at all?
Translational, you mean?
Yes.
This is a question that we ask because we use also cyclohexamide to see if we are seeing some reduction of the phenomenon and so on. We don't think that we have a translational silencing. You think siRNA or microRNA? You are wondering a microRNA?
You have different argonauts. You might think that you also have something like that.
We have two different argonauts. One is the QDE2, and one is a nuclear one. But I will talk about that in the next lecture to show that as a different mechanism there that do another very interesting job. But give me time to do it, otherwise it's already, I'm taking all your energy already, because I'm speaking maybe too much. I wanted to know, there is any limiting factor in this mechanism? Is it QD3 the limiting factor? Is QD1? Is it QD2? And so I tested overexpressing those three genes in Neurospora to see if I could get better efficiency. I showed you that only 30 to 50% of the strain containing the transgene show the silencing phenotype. So I asked myself, why only 30 to 50% and not all of them? And so I said, there must be a limiting factor. So I increased the concentration of each of those three genes to see if I could increase the efficiency of silencing. And turned out that the overexpressing QD3 or overexpressing QD2 didn't change much. But when I overexpressed QD1, I had an increase up to 95%. In a sense that the QD1 is the limiting factor of gene silencing. If I increase the concentration of this particular protein, at the level of protein, then mostly of the transgenic sequences will be recognized as a trigger for inducing silencing, and the silencing will take place in almost every transformant. Only, remember that I told you need tandem repeats, a long one, Well, even with a shorter one, as long as 2-3 repeats, with overexpressing QD1, that will be enough to trigger silencing. Otherwise, you need to have an average of 7 to 8 to have silencing. So the limiting factor seems to be QD1. We don't know yet why, but for sure, when we have a strain that overexpresses QD1 and you introduce any transgene, the vast majority of the transformants will have will be silenced. And then when you monitor how many transgenes they have, the number, average number, is much lower. Okay. And then we learned that was quite a bit of time ago, that palindromic sequences of roughly 300 base pairs are also very efficient in inducing gene silencing, in a sense that roughly 90 to 95% of the transformant with the palindrome do silence the homologous gene. And the reason, I believe, is because a palindrome doesn't need to be made double-stranded by QD1, which is the limiting factor, and so you have an abundant production of double-stranded and eventually silencing. Okay, so now I'm going to show you a cartoon. This is the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase that will make the single-strand RNA, as you see, double-stranded. Okay, this is a nice cartoon to show what happened in the cell. And now you're having double-stranded RNA. And so here is Dicer that comes and cleaves every double-stranded RNA in a fragment. You know, any double-stranded will be cleaved in many times. Here it's shown only once, and the rest is discarded, but it's not. Probably it does work on any fragment. And now there is an argonaut, or QD2, that comes and binds to the double-stranded, and some of our proteins are coming. This will be open. Now that QEP is known, probably you will have a different cartoon. This one will be degraded, no, by QEP. And now, you know, now you have this argonaut, which makes a complex called RNA-induced silencing complex, called RISC. And this RISC now is searching in every sequences. As soon as it's found the homologous one, it cleaves it in the middle, and now exonucleases will degrade everything. So this tells you exactly what happened into a strain where double-stranded RNA is present, either because it's been injected as double-stranded RNA by us, or because the transgene will be recognized and transformed in an RNA and then in double-stranded and so on. So this is the mechanism. So then 1998, Fire and Mello came out with a Nature paper, and they got a Nobel this year because of that. And they showed that transfection in elegans with double-stranded RNA lead to silencing of homologous sequences. Exactly what was already happening in Neurospora and in plants and in other organisms. But they were able to show for the first time that double-stranded RNA was the trigger of it. Because of this year they became more famous. So this is the organism that they were using. I won't tell you much about it, but they were able to silence a gene. The way they did it was simple. For recent rumors in their labs, says that they were using both a single-stranded antisense RNA and see if an antisense RNA injected into the cells was able to pair with a given target sequence, and then the pairing leading to block of translation or whatever. And so as a control, they were using the opposite strand. So they were injecting also a single-stranded sense RNA corresponding to the gene that they were going to silence. And at one point, for a reason that is not very clear, but by mistake I heard, because they really wanted, they mixed it. And they injected it as a double-stranded, and that produced 100 times more efficient silencing. And that was discovered, again by serendipity, of this mechanism that now will become one of the most important tool. It is already, but will become more and more for medicine and for biology. So why they were so lucky? I tell you why. I don't want to say they were lucky and we were not. We have done this experiment with double-stranded RNA 2 in Neurospora before then, but it didn't work. And I tell you why. Because we were in Neurospora, I remember that I told you it's syncytium and has a wall, so you cannot inject in such a tiny organism any given thing. So you have to start with protoplast, single cells called conidia, with 2, 3, 4, 5 nuclei, and you digest the wall, and then you are able to transfect it in with PEG, with calcium, a piece of DNA, a piece of RNA. So we were using double stranded RNA too, and then to show what happened there, you have to put it on the media and let this organism growing. At least 10 generations have to go, and then you form a colony, and the colonies were white. So we were seeing the phenotype. But then you say, well, white doesn't mean much. Let's take the colony and put it back on another media and see them growing more. And the phenotype was disappearing. Every time we were seeing a faint phenotype, not a clear, sharp-cut phenotype. And the reason is, when we studied that later, that Neurospora will not amplify the signal, okay? And so, if you, I show you the cartoon and then you will understand what I'm talking about. The cartoon is this. Now, you see this is the needle of fire, and Mello is injecting inside double-stranded RNA, dies here, they didn't know, but come, does the job, and now, this particular one will be recognized by Argonaut, will be opened up, and single-stranded RNA will be even released eventually. So this is what we have seen it already. We'll cut this, and aberrant RNA will be produced. You know, this one could be considered an aberrant RNA. And RNA-dependent RNA polymerase now will come. Okay, this is the degradation of it. And in elegance, there is an extra mechanism that is the following. This one is recognized, as I told you, by the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase in the cytoplasm, I guess. Dicer will cut it, will be open again. You see, there is an extra piece of information. This one will now fuse somehow, look, without risk. It's just a way to show that this one will work as a primer, okay? To be a primer for the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase that will use those tiny RNA as in a complementary form to form a double-stranded. The word doesn't come out. Sorry, and will be used as a substrate for the polymerase to do the job. And so this is an amplification step that in elegance works. And so you inject a very few molecules, but the number of molecules will increase and increase, and actually will be inherited somehow for the next two generations through abundant RNA produced from the from the original parents, let's say, that will accumulate into the sperm, and so through the sperm this RNA will be given to the next generation and we still work in the world. So they had a very special organism that for them was the luck to have this phenomenon. In Neurospora we showed that in Neurospora we show that this doesn't work because we measure if the primer was acting, because when a messenger RNA is cleaved, so if you imagine that the primer will bound to it and will transcribe it, okay, so you will be able to find siRNA coming from every portion of the messenger RNA. Our transgene was short and we were measuring if siRNA were coming also from the messenger RNA that was eventually cleaved by the siRNA. And we couldn't ever find siRNA coming from the amplification of the messenger RNA. Instead, in elegance, you can see that in large amount. Okay? In Neurospora, you cannot, so there is no amplification, and that's why we could not find that double-stranded RNA is working there. Please. As soon as you Dicer will cleave a double-stranded, those sequences could be used as a primer. And then you will have the primer sitting on a piece of messenger RNA that will be double-stranded, okay? And then you will have, again, cleavage of these. So you have many primers at one that act... Because you have many different primers. Every 20 nucleotides of your messenger, that could behave as a primer. And so you have primer of any kind, and you have a real amplification of the signal. So inelegant, very strong because of this. Implants also seems that is the same. Yeah. Not in neurospora. Neurospora doesn't do that. And neurospora has not been so nice with us, I have to tell you. And I tell you that neurospora has not been so nice to us in the next lecture, when I will show you that we were studying if those siRNA were also acting at the level of chromatin. And we were doing this 3 years in advance of the yeast lab. But neurospora does not have that mechanism. So I wrote a couple of papers showing exactly that doesn't have that mechanism. That's all right. So this is the pathway, and that you can in the nematode is here, and let's say mammals, but could be neurospora, the same thing. Double-stranded RNA. It is cleaved by Dicer, and this is the 21-25 double-stranded will be open, and that will be used, let's say, to cleave a messenger RNA. Instead, in nematode, you have the double-stranded that is carried by Dicer, and then these portions here could be used either to cleave a messenger RNA or to be used as a primer. And that will somehow increase, as I said, the number of siRNA, and will make the mechanism much more effective. So these are the two possibilities that I showed you before, in which you can have a primer or the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase working directly on the messenger RNA or a fraction of it. So that is very efficient and made Fire & Mello very rich, I would say. Or not? I would say yes. The translational? Yeah, but I didn't want to use these as a translational. Should I talk about translational regulation too? Not today.
No.
Not today. Well, this is just saying that Dicer is able to produce also tiny RNA that could not pair perfectly with the messenger RNA. And of course, these are, if you, you may know that already, I know that you have heard lectures about microRNA, and so this could be a microRNA that don't match perfectly, and so there is no cleavage of the messenger RNA, but there is only the block of translation, even though I have doubt about this, because we monitor also the degradation of messenger RNA by microRNA, so probably the mechanism is not so sharp that will block only translation. You have to excuse me, but I have problems on hearing.
MicroRNA can act also as sRNA. At the point where they have more than 11 exact binds,
They act as an siRNA. It has to be more than 11. So the cleavage, the 11 is exactly where argonaut will induce the cleavage. So use only the half of the sequence to decide if it is perfectly homologous, right? And then cleave it. This is the mechanism.
At the moment where there's more binding than 10 or 11 nucleotides.
But has to be on one end, or has to be in the middle, or where? Not yet, okay. So it's not clear yet which is the mechanism. Okay, so I try to finish soon. So widespread natural double-stranded RNA in eukaryotes. You see here trypanosomes and drosophilas and many others now. But what about mammalians? That was an important thing. And in mammalians, this is the first demonstration, and this is Christmas of 2000, when they showed that in a mouse embryo, you can have an overexpression of GFP. This is a transgenic embryo. And then they injected in those embryos double-stranded RNA against the GFP proteins, okay, messenger RNA. And they showed that the double-stranded RNA was able to shut off the expression of GFP. So that was the first demonstration that even in mammalian, the RNAi could function. But is there a mechanism in mammals? And so, unfortunately, as soon as they started to use double stranded RNA against the adult cells or the cultured cells, they discovered that the mechanism wasn't working at all. And the reason was that double stranded RNA, when it's long, over 30 to 50 nucleotides and longer, induce a specific mechanism that is interferon-mediated mechanism. And so there are two functions. Let's say this is a protein that phosphorylates an initiation factor, and so the phosphorylation of the initiation factor leads to block protein synthesis in general in those cells. So as soon as an adult cell see a double-stranded RNA, will induce and activate this particular PKC, a PKR, that will block protein synthesis, but also will activate an RNA cell that will degrade RNA, okay? And cells will die, so they go in apoptosis. So it's a way to rescue the life of the organisms. As soon as a viral RNA gets into the cell, is a double-stranded, then the cell will suicide and block, if you think, the expansion of the virus. So it's a natural defense mechanism against double-stranded RNA that usually are viral. But how come that it was possible to show it? Because in embryo, you have this mechanism, and you don't have this. Instead, in the adult cells, you have this, and maybe you have still this. But it's impossible to see it because this one will impede the measure or the activity of double-stranded RNA and the risk. And so, fortunately, El-Bashir and Tuchel published a paper a few months later in which they showed that using double-stranded RNA, but not long double-stranded RNA, but only 20 to 30 nucleotide-long duplexes RNA, they were able to silence a given gene without any problem. And the reason is because now they were introducing directly small RNA, and the interferon-mediated mechanism is not alarmed, because those are tiny, and they are loaded into RISC, and they do the job. So this is a real breakthrough. Now everybody in the world is using this system to try to tear it down, to knock down, the function of a given gene in mostly of the organism. So there are evidences for naturally occurring RNA in mammals. Well, the evidence are circumstantial, as you say. There are viral proteins that comes from influenza or vaccine viruses that are inhibitors of RNAi response both in mammals and Drosophila. So that tells you that those viral proteins have been evolved to fight the RNA interferences. And actually, those viral proteins that are present in most of the viruses now have been developed to fight against the mechanisms that will block virus expansion in mammals, and as you would see in many other organisms. But that is a next lecture story, when I will try to explain what naturally is doing the mechanism in cells. So it will be genome defense or epigenetic control or control development, but we will talk about this later on. Thank you very much, and if you have any questions, please feel free. It's a kind of long seminar, please.
I have a similar question going back to the beginning of your talk. The triggering of gene silencing crucially depends on the presence of double-stranded RNA. What's the nature of the transgene which so specifically introduces dsRNA?
A transgene made by DNA, it is inserted into the genome, and at that point you have an insertional, you could call it mutagenesis, but an insertion of a specific sequence. Why the cell recognizes that as a foreigner, okay, an invader? So the mechanism is that somehow the transgene is made multimeric and linked one to another and inserted as a tandem, okay? So one of the ways the neurospora or other organisms protect themselves is they somehow replicate the invader sequence. It could be either a plasmid or a virus and so on, and they make a tandem. As soon as this tandem is integrated into the genome, now you have, during DNA replication, that strange structures are made because of the fact that they are homologous sequences. And now you have the RecQ protein that comes that has to solve those structures, and some polymerase that has not yet identified in animals, but in plants is called POL4, okay, would do the job of transcribing that area. And because the RNA-dependent RNA polymerase sits in there, will make that transcript, original transcript that is made there, directly double-stranded. So the mechanism is an alarm system. An invader came, and I had to do something to fight it. And so transform the product of the invader in RNA, and in double-stranded RNA, and then the first sentinel there that will be shot against the invader is ISER. Any double-stranded RNA will be chopped, okay, in fragments. And the mechanism could be finished there. But then the smartness of those cells was to use the tiny double-stranded RNA, the tiny fragment, to load it in a protein called argonaut. And with that protein now, loaded with an RNA, you could go everywhere into the nucleus, in the cytoplasm and search for the products of the invaders, which are messenger RNAs or genomes, if in an RNA genome. And then you can really destroy genomes before they get integrated into the cell. So that is the real trick that the cell is using, not only killing the invader, but using that particular killing to amplify the system to search for others not yet integrated. Okay? Did I explain your question? Okay.
I'm curious about maybe a very simple answer, but I don't understand why your 3' UTR did not work inside.
No, when we tested it, the efficiency was zero. Okay? And I have to say that when you go very close to the end, that's a question that I ask myself many, many, many times, but never done heavy experiments because you cannot do everything. It's impossible. But as soon as even the coding portion was nearby the 3' UTR, that efficiency was much, much lower. Okay, so I don't know. Loaded on ribosomes? Oh, yeah, it may be. Yeah. And that will. Yeah. We couldn't find them. Maybe they are there, but we could not. Your vision, it's an RNA vision. But imagine that I'm using a transgene, okay, that contains the sequences from the 3' and the plus, maybe a little bit of coding at the carboxy terminus, okay. That part will be integrated, and now an RNA is made. Why is not made double-stranded? Why is not effective on degrading? You're saying proteins bound to the 3' end of a messenger RNA. But we are talking about, you know, a sequence that only producing siRNA from it would degrade everything. So, you see, the vision that you had is an RNA already made that has proteins bound to it, and then the mechanism may not work. Here you are just saying, I made a double-stranded RNA from any region, and then Dizer will destroy it, okay? Doesn't mean that you need to have proteins on it, you know? So I'm not sure that your way to explain it is what may happen in the cell.
So in mammals, there are lots of cases where it seems that the gene is transcribed, but that you have also transcription on the strand, and so which is certainly longer than 21.
Sure, absolutely.
So why does this kind of mechanism not trigger, say, interferon response or other things?
Well, it very much depends on, again, this interferon one takes place in the cytoplasm, or I would say that takes place in the cytoplasm, okay? Instead, what you are having into the nucleus, you are talking about a possible double-stranded into the nucleus. So that could be one of the reasons why it doesn't trigger it. And then, again, those, are you sure that they will pair? as soon as an RNA is made, it is covered by proteins, even to the nucleus. And so are they going to get together and making a double-stranded? Not necessarily, you see. So I'm not sure that the first explanation, that is the localization of the double-stranded, is the correct answer. Maybe they won't meet just because of the fact that they are impeded by proteins. Instead, when it's a palindromic sequence, then snapping back is much easier, and so it takes place. So you can make it double-stranded, but it has to be a palindrome, not complementary. The 5'? In Neurospora, they are very short, and so we never really measure anything using only the UTR. When we did it, always there was some coding portion, and that was very efficient. But in principle, I would say there is no reason to think that the 5' UTR is not good for degrading the messenger RNA it made, but it's difficult to do it in that organism. I thank you for your patience.